to continue on a somewhat different subject, what was the Jewish reaction to the idea that was put forward partly by Trigvi Lee quite early of a international military force to maintain order in Palestine? This was amplified later, I think, at the third session of the General Assembly, when Trigvi Lee proposed specifically a constabulary, an armed constabulary.
The weak point of the November resolution was what was called implementation. Here was a very surgical operation being suggested. Nobody was. The assumption was that it would be carried out peacefully. On what was that base when one of the parties said they didn't want anything to do with it? Who was going to keep order? And there was something rather unreal in that respect about the November recommendation, which was so detailed in other respects, even going to the question of the kind of structure of governments and democracy and self-determination and civil rights, but not going to the question of enforcement. Of course, this reflects the general weakness of the UN system and especially of the General Assembly. Later we were going to see the attempt to make the General Assembly a surrogate for the Security Council, uniting for peace. But Trigvi Lee was actually completely correct. He supported the armed partition very actively. Incidentally, both he and Hammarskjöld showed a predilection for there was always a secretary's view. He was for the partition of Palestine. He was for recognition of communist China. Trigvi Lee really began this. Just as there were governments which had their position, the Secretary General had positions, and usually on the most sensitive issues. Which of course meant he stirred up the enmity of those opposed to it. Got the admiration of those who we greatly admired Trigvi Lee, and he was our ally. But the idea of a constabulary, it was the United States was very apprehensive. In fact, it led eventually to their temporary abandonment of the partition idea, because it really meant that they were going to take over the British role. What it involved in constabulary, namely you enforce, you punish, you provoke, you enrage, you arrest people, you put them in jail. The United States, one must remember, was very reluctant about assuming the British. They wished to God that the British would just stay where they were. There was a kind of a contradiction in American policy which enraged the British, incidentally, one of the reasons why Bevan went. Now, on the one hand, anti-colonial rhetoric all the time.
Yeah.
Churchill was irritated by Roosevelt. On the other hand, when it came to the point, they wished the British would just get on with it in Greece and in Turkey and in Palestine and in Iraq. And because so long as they were there, the United States didn't have to enlarge the range of its responsibilities. But by 1947, I think the Truman Doctrine for Greece and Turkey was already enunciated.
Yes.
Not only was it unrealistic to have a constabulary, even the Partition Commission would not be allowed in. It's a very interesting development that the British hostility to partition, illogical and historically, because they were the authors of the idea, took the form that there was this five-member commission: Czechoslovakia, Denmark, Bolivia, Panama, get the fifth one. they wouldn't even let them go into the area to carry out the partition resolution. All they did was to make a judgment that the Arabs were at fault in defying the United Nations resolution. They were called the Five Lonely Pilgrims. The Philippines was the other.
Yeah.
As though somebody, I don't know what Trigvi Lee was doing there. He seemed to choose the least significant people he could. There are much more significant Latin countries than Bolivia and Panama. And there are much more Denmark. At any rate, this commission was inept, and it was quite obvious that by the end of 1947 that the matter would be decided on the battlefield, not by some United Nations enforcement.
Yes.
You must remember that there had already been a collapse of the charter provisions on the military staff. They were meeting ridiculously every month, very high officers, American and Soviet and British and French and Chinese. They then, after 5 minutes, said, "We have noted that we've met," and they went home. So the idea of the UN as an enforcing agency had been weakened in general, and therefore the idea that in the particular case of Palestine there would be a UN constabulary was very unlogical but unreal.
And so on the Jewish side, you did not attribute great importance to the...
It was obviously not going to happen, and we obviously have to fight for ourselves. And the Arabs understood it. In my talk with Azam, I remember he said, "You'll only get your state if you fight, and if you win, and if you don't win, you won't get your state. But we're going to try and prevent it." It was not... the UN hadn't built the kind of image that would make people... I don't think there was any serious discussion in Washington or in Britain. The British were afraid that in the end, if you said constabulary, they would be asked to stay on. And they really didn't want to stay on. Which I understood, because if they'd given up India, what's the use of Palestine? Palestine was regarded as a series of bases. There was Malta, Cyprus, Palestine, stepping stones on the way to India. If you don't have India, you don't want anything on, you don't need to be on the way to nowhere. And if you're going to have a major decolonization, these places have lost. They weren't important enough. 100,000 British troops would be tied down when the war was ended. A country which would sustain massive losses if there was a war, but the war ended and they were getting killed, their public just couldn't stand it. And they said, "Now what for?" It was very hard to say what for. It wasn't a source of mineral wealth or anything. So they were getting it was like, for them, it was a beehive without honey. You've got the stings and you've got nothing out of it.
Mr. Ambassador, you mentioned in this connection that the idea of the constabulary might have had some effect in Washington and the move away that Washington took away from the partition idea. You have discussed this in your autobiography, of course. It remains somewhat mysterious how the United States could have switched positions so suddenly without any warning, and quite contrary to the indication that President Truman had given before.
Yeah.
I wondered, are you still inclined to attribute this this initiative in the Security Council to the influence of the State Department on American policy, or have you gained new perceptions on this situation?
All the new perceptions support the idea that in this case the State Department was not very careful about getting presidential support. Truman made his dramatic gesture on the 14th of May, and there's a book now in the bookstores about General Marshall. Also, in my interview with Clark Clifford, which for the television series, the virulence of Marshall's opposition to it only surprises me very much. He was almost insubordinate.
He was opposed to partition.
Yes, when the recognition of Israel was in May,
yes,
came up, he really was insubordinate to his own president. He said, "If you do this, it's just politics, and if you do this, I mightn't vote for you." And Truman, who revered Marshall, said, "Okay, that's one vote less," but it had to be fought very, very heavily. In March, why they abandoned it, I think, was clear. First of all, they didn't think we were going to make it. We must remember that this myth of Israeli military invincibility. Our military situation was very, very bad in February, and we were going to lose, and our own Haganah leaders were saying that it's not sure that we can do this. And here we are only fighting volunteers, not the official Arab armies. They haven't crossed the frontier. And yet Jerusalem is cut off, the Negev is cut off, the Arabs have seized points of communication, the Jewish state is fragmented. There's the Arabs very cleverly didn't try to defeat the Israeli armies, but to seize communication points. The United States was watching us with skepticism. That's on the local scene. They thought that, that there's going to be a massacre, and they would have to come in and rescue us. They were getting reports from people like Marshall, General Montgomery, was saying in March that the Jews are really, I forget his slang phrase, but they've got a hot potato there. They can't do it. The French were always saying it's absolutely impossible. And on the international level, the Soviet Cold War pressure was intense. The prospect of war. Czechoslovakia was invaded. NATO was established. And people like the Pentagon, Forrestal was there saying the Arabs are beginning to cancel oil contracts. So there was a feeling that it was beyond the possibility, beyond Israel's power to implement partition, and it was against American interest to fight for it, and therefore they said, let's stop and have another look. And the other look was a little bit absurd, the idea of a trusteeship. But let us halt the dynamism at which the state is established. And
so this underlay.
Truman was surprised because he met Weizmann the day before.
Yes.
And they talked about partition. And Clifford is going to illuminate this in my own book. And the next morning he reads that Austin, either he was a little vague, I don't know what happened. I think after November 29th, Truman thought, well, that's matter settled, he'll go and deal with other matters. And he left the whole thing alone. He doesn't figure in the history very much between November and March.
Yes, yeah.
And then when he heard of this, oh my God, what's happening here? All hell breaking loose, and the Zionists rampaging. And it's then that he, very conscience stricken about deceiving Weizmann, and sending Judge Rosenman to see Weizmann to say, if you decide nevertheless to establish a state, I'll recognize it. I won't take responsibility for being for it, but if you take responsibility, okay. So that the gap was very strong, but this description of the recognition meeting on May the 12th, this biography of Marshall indicates how the confrontation was so great that after the meeting, Lovett, Undersecretary, yes, called up Marshall and said, there's a great danger here that the administration, that there'll be a Truman-Marshall rift, which will of course destroy the cohesion of the Truman administration. The Democratic Party saw what kind of a chance of winning an election would they have if there was a rift at that high level. Marshall was more than just a Secretary of State. He was a figure in his own right. He had probably been president himself. And therefore, they thought that this declaration of Jewish independence was going to be a headache, and they tried to stop it.
And then in due course, apparently,
It did show the president was not the president who had been elected. That's another matter. He had been a vice president. And he was not the very assertive Truman of the next four, from 48 to 52, a completely different person.
Yeah.
Well, I've been elected, and you just do what you're told at the end of it. He didn't have that sort of approach then.
But apparently, then, for his part, Truman never told the State Department of his conversation with Judge Rosenman or his intention to.
Obviously, yes. Well, because it doesn't figure at all in the May discussions. But they must have been suspicious that when he recognized it 10 minutes afterwards, it must have been clear to Marshall and others that he had thought this all out before.
Yeah.
And that isn't a decision taken in 12 minutes. In other words, the whole thing was laid on before.
Ambassador Abram, before we leave this period, I want to go back just a minute to the Soviet attitude, which you have referred to, which was really very positive. And I wonder, what explanation do you have for the strong and consistent support of the Soviet Union at that time for partition and for the Jewish state? especially in light of the subsequent history.
You really have to look to the general foreign policy considerations of Moscow. They came out of the war terribly, more than 20 million dead, and suspicious that everybody who could invade the Soviet Union would. And the central aim of their foreign policy was to get rid of the bases which surrounded them. They had, it sounds absurd when you look at the map, but they had a vision of encirclement. And that Western bases, and Western bases then meant British bases.
British, yes.
But for several years, the British in Palestine, the British in the Canal Zone, the British more in Habaniya Airport in Iraq. Even when the Arabs claimed freedom, they had no objection to having British bases in everywhere. And these kings and others, Nuri, they would sign up with the British. It was a tradition. In North Africa, if it wasn't British, it was French, and it was they hadn't shake them away, push them away. Explains their aggressive policy towards Turkey and Greece. And the people more likely to get the British to move out were the Israelis at that time. The Arabs, as I've said, they were being hit on the head very hard by the British for revolting against Britain. But in the end, they would settle for a base. I don't know if the Soviets understood that so would the Israelis in point of fact. But at that time, the people who were saying get out were the British, were the Israelis. And that's, I think, the only reason for that.
So there was a strategic concern.
Strategic concern, which had been a very important strategic concern. And this existed for those 2 or 3 years, and in the early 1950s they no longer had that concern. In other words, the Israelis had done their job of getting the British out. And now the Soviet policy was to win the Arabs over in their Cold War against the United States. But during that period, one must stress how vital they were, because they were more constant and more assertive in their support of Israel than the United States was. There were no wobblings, no vacillations. And in the end, without the Soviet Union, this generation would be said, we couldn't have made it, because without their 5 votes and without their Czech arms, we couldn't have made it either diplomatically or militarily.
Do you think that Ambassador Gromyko had very much influence in this policy, or was it strictly, as you say, strategic, determined presumably by Stalin himself?
I just read the memoirs of Gromyko. It's quite clear that he was the servant of policy, and he wouldn't have presumed to initiate policy. Once he was told that that was a policy, he played it very strongly and warmly and embraced it. And sentimentally, he reminded me of it later on in Geneva, 1967. I raised my vote in the Security Council, General Assembly, read my speech again. He became a Zionist hero. And but of course this came, and one must say, however uncomfortable it is, it came from Stalin. It came as part of a policy of how to get rid of this encircling grip.
To go back to the American switch.
Once they needed to do it, then they found the ideology, which they even talked a lot of Zionist ideology about the historical roots of Israel.
Even though they had opposed Zionism and for very good historical reasons, I think.
Continued to oppose Zionism in the Soviet Union.
Yes.
Gave us no help in the exit of Jews, but supported this national struggle with all the terminology of people struggling for independence, attacked the Arabs in vehement language. The Soviet Union then, for a long time afterwards, they were either for you or against you. If they were for you, they were 100%. If they were against you, it was 100%. The United States always had a plurality of objectives and tried to combine diverse objectives in a single policy, so they were never 100% for anybody, they were never 100% against anybody. Nobody could completely trust them, and nobody could completely despair of them.
Yeah. But you needed them.
Oh, yes.
Trivially, as you mentioned, took a very, very strong position in favor of the partition. And in fact, he appears to have been even more stunned than you were on the Jewish side by the switch in the American position and the initiative in the Security Council. He even threatened to resign, I believe, at one point. And I wondered, were you in direct touch with him
very
on this particular subject?
Yes. And what as far as you say, he was our great ally, or don't accept this, the Americans can be made to change. For him, it was a tremendous blow to the United Nations. In his book, In the Cause of Peace, he says this was the first attempt since the Second War to achieve a political aim by aggression. The UN system was in challenge. It was the first real action by the General Assembly. He thought it was making a fool of the UN, was making a fool of him personally. It was destroying the hope of that degree of authority that comes out of the myth of prestige. It was a terrible defiance of the UN system by one of the founders of the organization. And he became the ally of the Zionist lobby and working against it. I don't know how the views of the other secretary members are fairly hard. I thought that Robles was rather cool, and the legal advisor Stavropoulos somewhat hostile. I suppose you're talking to Brian Urquhart. I don't know how they...
Well, Brian was not too much involved at this point.
Yes, that's my impression.
Actually, the three that Lee seems to have consulted most closely at that point was Cordier and Protich and Sir Robert Jackson, who was a very young man at that point, who was kind of a troubleshooter for Lee at that point.
His chief fame was to be the husband of Barbara Moore.
Yes. Inconstant. I want to ask you one philosophical question, if I may. In your book, you refer back to your experience at the General Assembly in Paris, I think, in 1948, and you say that your legal advisor, whose name was Robinson, did more than anyone else to educate us all on the potentialities and limitations of multilateral diplomacy.
Yes.
And I wonder, how did you assess at that point the limitations and the potentialities of multilateralism, and how have you changed?
Well, it was completely new, because there was one power which counted, Britain. Okay, the United States would have some influence. There was the Permanent Mandates Commission, really learned and somewhat remote academic judges like Professor Rappard and others, Professor Humbrough. Basically, we had one central international relation. Now we had to worry about Paraguay, Uruguay, Iceland. It was quite a change. We had to adapt ourselves to a completely new technique. And the feeling was the United Nations was very important. It could really change, for good or for ill, the destiny of our history. The chief feeling was that failure would be catastrophic. It would lead to the loss of what we already had in the League mandate and the Balfour Declaration. And success would open new vistas. It must also be remembered that the UN at that time had great prestige. It was, I would say, the first 5 years were years of fluorescence. People took it very seriously. Some of its actions were actually implemented. They wanted Iran out, or they got out. They wanted Indonesia, the Dutch to leave Indonesia, they left Indonesia. It had impressive, as it were, psychological victories, like the Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. There was a tremendous press corps, much more coverage than now. Hundreds of journalists. Today, the general debate, foreign ministers will come here for 3 weeks and not leave New York, see each other, conduct transactions together, listen to each other's speeches. Today, as I have written, the speeches of foreign ministers in the general debate pass from ministerial lips into oblivion without even a temporary resting place in the New York Times.
Yes.
But then if you pick up New York Times in 1948 and 1949, two large pages with excerpts from speeches, there's a great sense of gravity, solemnity, importance, decisiveness. Now you can be here in the middle of October and not know if there's a session or not. New York society was dominated by the UN session. The Secretary General would give a dinner here, and the mayor would give a dinner there, and you would have Bevin and Acheson and Hobbes, Schumann, all these great luminaries. That was the United Nations that was dealing with our problem.
Yes. Now, if you look at the situation today, it could be suggested that there's almost a return to the situation of 1945, and that there is the degree of agreement and consensus among the five permanent members of the Security Council. And this has been reflected in some effective action by the Council or the Secretary General in the past 2 years. Has this influenced your, does this influence your perception of the potentialities of multilateralism as reflected in the United Nations during the coming period, where presumably this new relationship?
Well, first of all, the Israeli disillusion with the United Nations is understandable in the short term. It is not a very historical view.
What's bothering?
It's the maid who has to change.
Okay, that's me.
The
Why don't you switch the table?